Austrian-born turn Hollywood's bombshell. Hedy Lamarr was not just considered one of the most beautiful women in the world, but did you know that she invented Wi-Fi? I bet you didn't know that. When she met Louis B. Mayer, head of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, we might know it as MGM Studios, he offered her a movie contract and promoted her as the world's most beautiful woman. She became one of Hollywood's top stars. But little did we know that Lamarr was also an inventor. At the beginning of World War II, Lamarr and composer George Antheil developed a radio guidance system using frequency hopping spread spectrum. You know what? I'm not going to get into all that because that's way above my pay grade. But today we have a guest. Pulitzer Prize winning author Richard Rhodes is going to be talking about his book he wrote all about Hedy's life and her invention. It's titled Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, and it's such an honor to have the one and only Pulitzer Prize winner, Richard Rhodes. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for doing this so early.
No, it's my pleasure.
Well, first of all, I'm a big old Hollywood fan, and, you know, compared to even, you know, I'm 50, but the newer Hollywood doesn't interest me as much as the old Hollywood. It's just the glamour, the glitz, and the class and classy and all that stuff. But, you know, we've heard of Hedy Lamarr. You know, some people may not have, but there's a lot to Hedy that we did not know. And I wanted you to be able to introduce who Hedy is to the people in the new generation that doesn't know who she is. Would you mind kind of doing that introduction of Hedy?
Hedy Lamarr was an Austrian Jewish woman, although strangely enough, her children were never told she was Jewish. But she grew up in Austria, was a movie star at an early age in a rather scandalous movie where she appeared entirely nude in several scenes. Eventually, as you said, made her way to Hollywood because the Nazis were taking over Germany first and then Austria. And she had to get out of the country, as so many Jewish artists and writers had to during that period in the 1930s. She, as you said, went to Hollywood. It had always been her dream, and started out as a contract star at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. She very quickly became a superstar. But in the background was the fact that she was an extremely intelligent woman. She had grown up with a father who was interested in technology. They used to take walks together in Vienna, and he would show her, point to a streetcar and say, that runs on electricity, which is this line overhead, goes to a generating plant, and so forth. So she had a general sense that the world was organized with technology. And her husband in Austria had been someone who had been involved in munitions manufacture and engineering and had particularly focused on the problem of torpedoes. In any case, when she got to Hollywood, she became very interested in the problem of a torpedo, which in those days were unguided and therefore rarely hit their targets.
Well, as a writer, not me, you, as a writer, you know, you have, I don't know how many, 20-some books, 26 books, maybe?
Right.
Why was Hedy one of those figures that you wanted to write about? What was it about her that perked your interest?
It's interesting. I was on a book committee at a foundation in New York, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which has supported my work on writing a number of books. My best-known book is probably The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which was about the World War II development of the first atomic bombs, and which won a Pulitzer Prize and a number of other awards. So I was on the book committee and we were making a list. The foundation supported the writing of books about science and technology. Mm-hmm. We were making a list of 20th century inventors who might be interesting to, as it were, commission books about. And Hetty's name came up, and I was immediately fascinated. What was this famous, beautiful movie star doing on a list of inventors? And as soon as whoever raised the name described the person to me a bit and what she'd done, I said, I'll take that one. It was just simply too good to pass up. And so far outside my normal range, I knew it would be fun to do, and indeed it was.
Besides the Hollywood glamour of Hetty, and then finding out about her knowledge of science, was there anything else that really surprised you about her? Personality, or did she have a trait that doing your research that really surprised you?
You know, she was one of the very few Jewish artists from Europe, particularly in the film and theater business, who actually made it. By and large, it was just so difficult to transfer yourself, your identity, your experience, your language skills from Europe to Hollywood or to New York in the theater. That most of the people who came over really never got to the kind of peak she arrived at. What made her different?
You're
that
right.
was an interesting question. And I think the answer is she was really a woman who had been raised to take over. She was a very dominant and even domineering personality.
Oh, wow.
The way she convinced Lewis B. Mayer to take her on as a star was to ship over from Europe to the United States on the same ocean liner he was on, which means she checked it all out in advance and got her ticket. He had offered her a typical Hollywood starter contract of $1,000 a week and not very much in the way of benefits. She didn't think that was sufficient given her great reputation in Europe. By then she had made a lot of movies in Europe and been a star of the stage as well. So she wanted more from him. And the way she got that was to, while they sailed across the Atlantic, be seen on deck playing tennis with handsome young men and generally made it clear to him that she was a very exceptional in terms of beauty as well as her other qualities, human being. So before the ship landed in New York, they had negotiated a much more contract that was good for her, a lot more money and a lot more freedom to choose. That kind of quality is what I think made it possible for her to survive when others did not. And indeed, there turned out to be a small group of these emigres from Nazi Germany and Austria in Hollywood who were, and other artists of the period, Man Ray, the famous photographer, and Hetty used to play chess together. She had a lot of friends. And the reason she took up inventing was even because she was so different from the regular Hollywood people. She didn't drink. She didn't like to party. Her idea of a good time was to have a quiet dinner party with some intelligent people. So to fill the time, she set up basically an engineering table, a drafting table in her house, and had a wall full of engineering manuals of various kinds, and started inventing things. She invented a tablet, sort of like an Alka-Seltzer tablet, that you could drop into a glass of water that would fizz up and make an orange drink or some other flavor. This Howard Hughes, the famous Lothario and himself inventor in Hollywood, loaned her two chemists to help her with. She invented many other small but interesting inventions along the way. But the one that she did with Spread Spectrum was her most extraordinary invention of all.
Well, let's go back. I want to get into the invention part, but I want to go back a little bit because I find that her story is so interesting, especially, you know, we've heard of many women going into the, you know, not Hollywood at the time, because Hollywood really didn't exist way back when she, I'm sure, she, when she first started, maybe kind of did. But how you said she already had a lot of movies and a lot of projects that she did over in Europe. Can you kind of build on that a little bit and tell us about how she got into the entertainment industry at an early age over there?
She was really kind of an adolescent rebel. Her parents sent her off to a finishing school in Switzerland.
Oh, wow. Okay.
For girls only, which she didn't like. So she just walked out and came back to Vienna.
She's like, and, enough.
They accepted that and put her in school locally. But one day when she felt she was ready, she went over to the major film studio in Austria, one of the most important ones in Europe, and walked in and said, I want to be in the movies. And the whoever was there who was in charge took one look at this beautiful young woman and put her to work as a script girl for a while. But pretty quickly she got bit parts, non-speaking at first, right, and then speaking. And then she was tapped by a major director for a film that was going to be in the European tradition at the time of outdoor health and freshness and exercise, something that had really just been developing in Europe, partly picked up by the Nazis, as I think most people are aware.
Right.
But she was going to have to be nude in this movie. She didn't tell them her real age. She was only 17, which was too young to be in a movie as a nude actress.
Right.
So she told them she was 18. The movie is still around. Anyone who wants to look it up can do so. But she appears as a young woman who's swimming in a lake one day and steps out without any clothes on, and a handsome, tall, muscular, blonde railroad engineer from nearby gathers up her clothes and catches her and so forth. I won't repeat the plot of the movie, but basically she has a wimpy husband and he is totally destroyed and finally kills himself. Mm. There is a scene, however, where she has orgasm. And this was the most shocking scene in the film, particularly when it made it to New York, which it did fairly quickly. Europeans were perhaps more sophisticated about these things. She claimed later that the director was making her feign orgasm by sticking her in the backside with a pin. But I think anyone who sees the scene thinks perhaps it's actually real. In any case, it was a total scandal. And at the same time, it started her major career. She, for example, played the young princess of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in a big movie in Europe. And many other films like that, and also on stage, in right, musicals in particular. She met this wealthy man, Fritz Mandl, who was the second wealthiest man in Austria, and who owned a big empire of munitions, as I said. Mandl wanted this beautiful arm piece and courted her, and they were actually two people who got along. He recognized her intelligence and eventually married, but he was also a very suspicious man. And it troubled her greatly that he basically kept her locked up and had the maids pick up the phone extension whenever she talked to anyone on the phone. She called it her golden prison that she was in.
Wow.
She accepted that for a while, I suppose because her career was thriving. But Mandl didn't like her in plays. He felt it was somehow demeaning. You know, the whole tradition of theater has been mixed up with people of ill repute for the right, last 1,000 years. And that was his feeling, that she was not keeping up the front that he, with his wealth and his position, wanted her to maintain. She stayed that way until her beloved father, the man who had really been her closest model of what a man should be, died one day of a heart attack in their big apartment in Vienna, while she was sitting outside in a convertible with a friend talking. She was horrified. She said, if I had gone in at just at that time, instead of wasting my time sitting around out talking, I might have been able to save him. And it was a transition point for her. She spent a year dressed in black and mourning clothes, honoring his death. But then she decided, as he had always told her, she had to take control of her life herself. So that takes us up to the mid-1930s. And that's when she began to think about her long-standing dream.
Right, of Hollywood.
To go to Hollywood and become a full-scale international star.
Yeah, I lost my mother like 3 years ago, and it does change you. Losing a parent does change you. It makes you look at life completely different, especially if you're close to that parent. And I think, you know, I can see why, you know, it made her probably put things in perspective and say, you know, no, I'm going to take control of my life. And so that's interesting. How do you think that's where she began to become this strong woman after her father passed? Because like you said, she loved to, you know, take control and make things happen. Do you feel that that was when she started, or was she like that before? Do you know?
Well, you know, Mandel's courtship of her was extensive, as it had to be. She was a great beauty, and no doubt there were others who courted her as well.
Right.
So he really did bring her into his life as an equal, except, of course, for this one weakness that he had, that he was constantly afraid that his partner was somehow cheating on him. So there was a deep insecurity there for Mandel. But other than that, and probably that wasn't visible during their courtship, they went horseback riding together. They went hunting together. He had a hunting lodge deep in the forests of Austria. I visited it when I was doing my research. It was still there.
Oh, great.
A very elegant building.
Yeah.
He really did go through the whole business of bringing her into his life. And I think for a while that was enough.
Right.
I mean, here was a whole new world for this very young woman. She was only, 19 or so when she married him. So that was no doubt part of her growth as an independent human being as well.
Right.
She would have had to direct the servants and organize dinner parties with elaborate setups and famous people and powerful people. I mean, she really was his arm piece. And interestingly, he, as I said earlier, was involved with the problem of helping the Germans work out better torpedoes. And she would have been in attendance at the dinner parties where the Italian admirals and the German generals would have come to Vienna to talk to Mandel and to discuss these technical issues. She was never called on to discuss them, of course. She was just thought of as a beautiful arm piece, but she was listening. And later on, when she came to America, one of the things she told the U.S. government was, you know, you could ask me questions and I could answer them for you, which later some of her detractors took to be the height of arrogance. Who is this vapid movie star presuming to tell the U.S. government about technology? But in fact, what she meant was, you can debrief me on all that I learned sitting at the dinner table, listening to these people dealing with these secret technologies. So she picked up a lot of information about all this, just simply being Mandel's arm piece for a few years.
How did she get so involved? Because back then women were not considered leaders. They were, you know, kind of not secondhand, but they, you know, back then men looked at them as not equal. So how did men start listening to her? Was it just her knowledge, or was it her beauty? Was it a combination of it all?
Well, I think it was her father's influence. He raised her. She was an only child. He loved her very much. And he raised her as someone who had a brain, and he thought he'd encourage it and talk to her and got her involved and interested in technology, which was, after all, although he was a bank manager, which was his interest as well. So for her, I think the emotional ambiance of technology was, at least in part, the feeling that it connected her to her beloved father. You know, she was married 6 times in the course of her life. And she said more than once, "No man ever measured up to my father." So whether that's healthy or not, I think it gives one a sense of just how important he was to her, and therefore what an influence he had on her.
So, yeah, and was most of her marriages, because I didn't do any research on the marriages, were most of the marriages older men, powerful older men?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Older men, elegant men like her father.
Okay, so she looking for that father
later
figure.
On, she married simply because that was the source of income.
Oh, okay.
Later in her life, as her life kind of fell apart after she ceased to be in the movies. But at least in the beginning, she married men, often the wrong people for her, the hence divorces, because they reminded her of her father.
Wow.
A screenwriter who was tall and distinguished looking and so on along the way, a British actor who was the same. He prepared her, I think, as did Mandel in a way, to be able to step forward in her own right. And at a time when, as you say, women generally did not do that.
Right.
Well, I've lost my thought.
That's okay.
As we do.
That's okay. Well, actually, this will go to our next point of her Hollywood career. How far did the Hollywood, not the European, but the Hollywood career last? Because she was, you know, one of the top female actresses in Hollywood. How long did that career last?
Well, she aged out, as do most female stars in Hollywood. She started around 38, 39.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of, by 1945, she was beginning to drop off the radar a little bit, mostly because she didn't like the studio system. Studio system worked everybody to death. There was a lot of amphetamine use in Hollywood in those days to keep everybody going. They would work 6 and 7 days a week. They would work 12-hour days. They really were worked like cattle in the barn. And the scripts were not necessarily what she wanted. She was... Her first movie, which was absolutely glorious movie with Charles Boyer, was called Algiers. There's a moment in the movie when she steps out of the shadows into the light that was just bang. That's when she became a superstar. Mm. She really was a very beautiful woman, so much so that when she walked into a room, conversation stopped. Yes, there you see.
That's gorgeous.
Just a
beautiful.
Gorgeous person. But because of that face and because of that beauty, she rarely was seen beyond that face. She said once, with great contempt, she said, "I can tell you how to be a movie star. All you have to do is stand still and look stupid." She really resented the fact that people didn't see her in her complexity. On the other hand, it was her beauty primarily that made her wealthy and famous. And so she had a kind of a dilemma on her hands. The quality that saved her from the Holocaust, if you will, the quality that made her wealthy and famous, was the very quality that she respected least about herself. At least so she said. Who knows?
Right.
I'm sure it was more complex than that.
Right.
And I find it fascinating too, because a lot of people, I was going to make a joke, you know, I know what she went through when it comes to looks, and I was just kidding on that one. But, but you know, a lot of people, when I was younger, you know, I was the muscle guy and the blonde hair and the country boy. And so people don't take you as serious until they get to know you. But being a woman, beautiful back then, like I said, getting it, that's what fascinates me the most, is being able to work with the Howard Hughes and people listening to her ideas. So could you tell us one of her first inventions that really got noticed? Was it the tablet, or was there another one that people took note of her ability?
No, I don't think people were aware of her as an inventor, even after the one that is the focus of my book. That's a story in itself. But
yeah, we're going to get to that.
That invention wasn't really recognized till long after it happened. In fact, it was in the early 1950s, and the invention was patented in 1942.
Really?
So... but because it was patented in her married name, which was Hedwig Kiesler, her actual name was Hedwig Kiesler, and her married name was Hedwig Kiesler Markey. Mr. Markey was her husband at the time. Nobody knew it was her. It was only by accident later that that was discovered, and she was identified as the co-inventor of this deep and fundamental electronic technology.
What's funny is, you know, nowadays you would instantly put that on social media and, you know, pretty much brag about it. Why did she not want to talk about that side of her? What would have hurt her reputation, maybe?
I don't think so. I think, in fact, she was perfectly willing to talk about it, but it was a different world.
Yeah.
Once she had, I mean, this was a hobby for her. And once she had finished an invention and in a few cases patented it, she didn't take it any farther. Most people think that when you do an invention, it immediately conquers the world.
Right, right.
But the truth is, most of the work of making an invention real, at least used to be, it's a little different now, is involved in finding a manufacturer,
right,
finding someone to support its development, fighting off those who are fighting your patent, who claim to have a similar patent. By and large, most inventions die on the vine for that very reason. So she wasn't particularly interested in pursuing it. She felt, I think, having done it, that it was up to other people. This was an invention that was intended to be something that would direct torpedoes. She was concerned about, let's just describe it briefly. She was concerned because she was a European, however much she might have changed into an American citizen.
Right.
And between the beginning of the war in Europe and America's joining the war, there was a period of a couple of years. The war began in Europe on September 1st, 1939. The war began with the United States with the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. So between that time, most Americans were not terribly interested in the war. There was something happening over there. But for her, as a European by birth and by spirit, it was a vital thing that was going on. And all the more horrible for her because her native country, Austria, was on the side of Germany.
Right.
So she followed the war very closely. And when she read about ships being torpedoed by German subs, and in particular, a shipload of children, the British were shipping their children to Canada to get them out of the German bombing of England, the so-called Blitz. And here was a load of several hundred children on a passenger liner that was torpedoed with a great loss of life. That horrified her, and she decided she could do something about it. And she went to work thinking about how you could guide a torpedo so that the Allied forces, the British forces, the American forces, would be able to take out those submarines, and they would not be able to kill children by, by torpedoing liners full of small children. So that was the basis for the work she did.
And who did she take this to help create it or help build on what she brought to the table?
So now we bring in a really interesting character, an avant-garde American composer named George Antheil.
Who would have thought, oh, let's go to a composer?
You would think it would be an engineer, but
right.
Antheil's most famous work, it's still played sometimes, was composed for 15 player pianos and drums, sirens, cymbals, anything you could make noise with. It was total cacophony, but it's a wonderful piece. It's about 20 minutes long. In the course of this, George got very interested in how player pianos work. Anyone who's ever seen a player piano and opened the cabinet has seen, there's George, yes. He was a good-looking guy, and he had a lot of trouble with that, much as I guess she did in her way.
Right.
Anyway, George was in Europe at the same time, and his brother was with the U.S. State Department and was one of the first Americans killed in the Second World War. He was in a plane flying to Norway, if I recall, carrying a dispatch bag of State Department documents when the Russians, who were fighting the Finns at that point, shot the plane down. George was determined to get involved in the war in some way. He had been Europeanized by living in Europe for 10 years as a conductor and a composer. And when Hetty mentioned to him, they were at a dinner party together, these nice little dinner parties that she enjoyed, and so did he in Hollywood. By then he'd moved to Hollywood to write movie music, because it was a good way to make a living, and his avant-garde music wasn't supporting him very well.
Right.
So he met Hetty at a dinner party, and they struck it off with their common interest in the European war. And pretty quickly, when she raised the question of this idea that if you could guide a torpedo with some sort of radio signal between the ship and the submarine, or the ship and a plane, you could do a much better job of hitting a target. He thought the question was, how would you guide? You'd have to have something playing, if you will, in, let's say, the plane,
right,
that was synced to something playing in the torpedo. And for him, the idea was, well, yeah, the same kind of scrolling tape as you would have in a player piano. Now, he wasn't thinking of a giant scroll the way player piano scrolls are. He was thinking, he said, you could make it so small you could put it in a watch. It would have to be just a thin wire, as long as it was punched or in some way. Player piano tape has holes in it.
Right.
The holes, as they play, roll over a bar with little windpipes on it, let air through the holes, and those actuate the keys that are connected to those particular air pressure tubes. And that's how the player piano plays. So the holes drive the mechanism for the player piano. In the same way, a small version of this tape would drive, if they were time synced so that they were running at the same speed, would drive the tape on the torpedo, and it could thereby be turned and directed by the plane, or by, it could be on a ship as well. So his knowledge of player pianos and her knowledge of her basic idea, because she really didn't know much about technology beyond just what a kind of amateur inventor would know.
Right.
They brought together into an invention that was sufficiently interesting. There was a board, a national board, that was set up during both world wars to take in ideas for valuable wartime inventions from civilian sources, both professional and amateur. And if they had value, to pursue their development at government expense. That group was so interested in this player piano technology, right, if you will, which they called frequency hopping, which I'll explain in a moment, that they assigned a physicist who was a specialist in radio frequency controls to George and Hetty to help them develop the electronic part of their idea. And the patent, the invention was indeed developed among these various people to the point where Hetty and George got a patent for it. Unfortunately, the American torpedoes were so bad, something like 60-70% of our torpedoes never hit their targets. All they did was identify where they came from, and the largest casualties among our Navy forces were in the torpedo, the submarine corps. It was right. It was almost a death trap to be in an American submarine during World War II, despite all our wonderful movies about it. That's another story. We can get to that. But for now, simply to see these two people coming up with an extraordinary invention. What's extraordinary about the invention really isn't that it was a torpedo. That's one application and the only one they were really focused on.
Right.
What's extraordinary is they were concerned that the signal not be jammed by the enemy. So the signal between the ship and the torpedo had to be something that could change often enough that you couldn't track it down and jam it with a large radio signal. That's where this frequency hopping business, the idea was that the signal would jump from frequency to frequency, and the two tapes would be able to make those jumps simultaneously,
right,
and therefore be in continual radio communication. Whereas someone from the outside, not knowing where the next signal was going to land, wouldn't be able to keep up with it.
Right.
At that time, it typically was like 5 or 10 times a second it would change frequency. Later on, we got them up, of course, to the hundreds and thousands. So it was the frequency hopping part that was really fundamental. And when the patent then was rediscovered long after the war, it had been, the Navy had thrown it into a safe somewhere and marked it as top secret. So nobody knew it was there for many years. But after the war, someone was looking through all the old patents and tossed this one to an engineering development company and said, see if there's anything in this. And when they realized what the frequency hopping could do for radio communications between ships, it was developed as the major radio signal process for U.S. Navy ships.
Wow.
The first time ships were fitted out with this technology was during the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s, when it was not actually used because the ships at that time were all put on radio silence. But as the ships were then returning to their bases in the Mediterranean, they did start using frequency hopping, and it became the standard mode of communication among Navy ships. It was later applied as well to GPS uses frequency mm-hmm. hopping, Bluetooth uses frequency hopping, some cell phone systems use frequency hopping. So it was a deeply fundamental technology that these two people, these unlikely pair, a composer, conductor,
and
a Hollywood actress, developed to help out with the war effort.
I mean, it really changed the future of technology. That's like you said, it's fascinating. I guess you can never rule anybody out of ideas, because who would have thought? You would think it would be some, you know, guy and a scientist and studied for years and years and years and that brought this technology, but no, it wasn't. That's fascinating.
Inventors are a really interesting group. They're often not people with great technological backgrounds, but they have a particular way of looking at the world. Hetty certainly did.
Yeah,
if she saw something that she didn't think worked very well, she would set out to try to figure out how to fix it. She developed something some improved version of a stoplight. She developed a chair on a kind of a axis that could be swung in and out of a shower so that someone who couldn't stand up in the shower could shower sitting down and then swing themselves out to dry off. These are simple things, and who would bother with them? But but for her, it was just this continual improving of the real world. And her glorious frequency hopping invention was the greatest of them all.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, we use these cell phones,
exactly.
And it wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for that.
And you think about it, if, you know, the first application of civilian frequency hopping was the car telephone. If you had to use one frequency for each car telephone conversation, there are only about 100 that would be available in any city. Hmm. That would mean you could only have 100 car telephone conversations going at the same time. It never would have worked. But with frequency hopping, you could have tens and hundreds of thousands, and they would almost never bump into each other. And if they did, it would just be for a fraction of a second. So it made possible all of these communication systems that we now have.
I can't believe time is going. We have about 8 minutes left, but I have two questions. So I normally, and I'm going to ask a question. I call my people in the chat room my co-host, because, you know, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have anything to really talk about. I'm going to ask a question from Stacy here in just a second, but I want to find out how Howard Hughes and Hetty, what did they do together technology-wise? Not just working together. Did they work together technology-wise, or only with his, because I know he also did a lot of movies.
I don't know about Hetty's movie. I don't think she did movies with him. I mean, he'd like to sleep with Hollywood actresses, and I have no doubt his helping her out on her invention was part of that plan. Right. Whether it came to fulfillment, I don't know. She was pretty quiet about her relationships.
Right.
but he certainly was willing to help her with this very simple invention. She said later, and I never was quite clear about it, but she said there was something about the waters that you dropped these tablets in that they didn't work properly. I don't quite understand that, because anyone who's ever taken an Alka-Seltzer or dropped any, you know, understands that
right. You
put some CO2 generating material in a tablet, it's going to fizz up the water. So I don't know what happened to that. It never came to anything. Perhaps he didn't develop it because that wasn't his purpose in the first place.
Right,
I would say. But and again, because she was an amateur and because she wasn't really interested in the industrial side, if you will, the investor side of all of this, she made her money making movies. When she presented this to the Navy, they basically, I left this out of the story, and it's a very funny part of the story. Antheil said later that when he took this invention to the Navy, they looked it over and said to him, "What do you want to do? Put a player piano in a torpedo? Get out of here." And nobody was interested in the Navy Department. Maybe it happened that way. Antheil liked to make up stories. But certainly when she was discussing this with the military, their response was, you know, you'd do us a lot better if you would go out and raise money for war bonds.
Right.
War bonds were things you could buy during the war.
I know she did very well.
So she said, all right, I can certainly do that for you. And to show them, she went out and raised the equivalent of $100 million today. Just by going from town to town and selling kisses. People would pay $25,000 in 1943 dollars to give Hetty a little kiss. So she proved her point. She could do it either way, but she thought her invention was the more valuable.
That's hilarious. I have to pay people to give me a smooch, so I couldn't get it. All right, so Stacy in the chat room, and I, because truth be told, we deal with a lot of historical figures. We talk to people about, you know, controversial stuff, and but I just found her story very fascinating. And so Stacy wanted to know. She goes, "I relate to Hedy so much, too much to type and boring for y'all. Just wondering if Hedy was also inclined to or interested in the paranormal or electric side of life. Do you know, did she ever dabble that you know of or anything into like the paranormal, like psychic abilities? Because a lot of times we hear people with these visions, you know, come through a paranormal type of a, if it's through a dream or whatever. Do you know anything about that?"
You know, I don't, there was nothing in the research that suggested she did. And the fact that her father was so interested in down-to-earth technology, showing her how a streetcar works and an electric supply in a city.
Right.
Makes me think that she was probably pretty focused on the real world. She, you know, wanted to have her own production company and make her own film. She always felt she was undervalued as an actress, and perhaps she was. And that's really what got her at odds with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer ultimately. She simply stopped performing for them. She would call in a bed and take a nap in the middle of a shoot to everyone else's deep frustration. And they finally let her go. And that was around 45. And she never really made a go of it as a producer either. So I don't think she went that route. I could see how she might have, but I don't think she did.
Great. Well, what's your take on, or what do you want people to walk away after reading your book? What do you want them to know about the lovely Hedy?
You know, I think the quality that I liked best about her was her standing up for herself, her deciding that she was an individual of quality and intelligence, and even if she had to compromise in many ways because of the circumstances of the coming war and then the war itself, she was going to step forward in the world in her own right and do what she could as well as she could. Her patriotism, her gratitude to the United States for taking her in. So many of the people she knew in Europe were murdered by the Nazis. She kind of faded away later in her life and always was unhappy not to have been recognized for her invention, because she kept track of all of its permutations later on.
Right.
And it was only when she was in her early 80s, in the 1990s, that some of the engineers and fellow inventors who were of an age to have been teenage boys when she was a movie star, when they figured out that Hedwig Markey was Hedy Lamarr, they went off on a concerted campaign to give her the recognition they felt she deserved.
That's great.
And when finally it came in the form of an award, her response when they called her up and told her was, "Well, it's about time."
That's
which I
funny.
Think sums up the kind of quality. She then decided in her 80s that she was going to live to see the new century come in. And she died in January of 2001.
Wow. Good for her.
I should say.
Good for her.
So she made it.
So
her last determined thing to do. It was an unusual and amazing human being, really.
Did she do any other inventions after all of that? Did she keep creating and inventing other things into her later life?
Well, the stoplight was a late invention.
Oh, that was a later
one? The
chair
for the shower was a late invention. There probably were others. It's
just, we don't know about.
They're lost, I'm afraid, in the record. So.
Yeah. Well, Richard, you I can see why you're an award-winning author. You're a great storyteller, and I think that's what makes a great author. And I appreciate you sharing the story of Miss Hedy, because you know it's well deserved. And like you said, a lot of people just don't even know who she is for her Hollywood abilities, but just the inventions that she created that changed the way we live today. So. That's why we call her Mother of Wi-Fi.
So go to anyone who wants to see her at her best, go back and look up this movie, Algiers, with Charles Boyer. It's an amazing movie.
Well, we'll have to put it on in our
very much.
Yeah, we'll have to put it in our chat room so people can remember that movie so they can go back and watch it. But thank you so much. You'll have to come back and talk about maybe one or two of your other books, because some of that
Absolutely.
Stuff is.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
And people can go to richardrodes.com. You can see it on the below screen. If you're listening to the audio version, it's just Richard Rhodes, and it's RHODES.com. And go to Amazon, go to his website. I'm sure you can pick up the books anywhere books are found. And so, but we appreciate you guys for always tuning in, participating in the chat room, and we love having you. And please share the show. We want to get more eyes and ears on Miss Hetty. We want to get her recognition going out there. So, but until next time, I'm Tony Sweet for Truth Be Told. Thank you, Richard, and hopefully we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
You got it. This has been another episode of Truth Be Told. Thank you so much for watching. Recorded live at UBNGO Studios in Burbank, California. Join us on social media. Facebook, Truth Be Told Radio. Instagram, Truth Be Told Paranormal. Go to Truth Be Told Worldwide for more information on upcoming shows. This has been an